Good morning, everybody. It's actually Tuesday at around 12:30. I am in the sanctuary. It's completely empty. We had some technical difficulties this week, so I'm having to re-record the message. So if it sounds a little odd because there's no crowd noise, that's because there's nobody here. So with that, here we go. I was out climbing the other day at a climbing gym, and I've never seen a fight at a climbing gym, but that day it almost happened. See, I was talking to this guy about a root on the wall, and for those of you who don't know about climbing gyms, just a bunch of fake holds bolted to a wall with tape saying you can use these holds, but don't use the other holds. I was talking to this guy about this one hold that you kind of had to hold with your hand upwards, and he was spitting mad. So I asked him, what's going on? He said earlier that day, somebody had told him that instead of holding that thing with three fingers, he should hold it with four fingers. It would be much better. He could probably do the climb then. And this is a totally normal thing. You see someone climbing a route, if you see someone climbing a route and you can give them some advice on how to finish the route, you do it. It's called beta. And you'd be kind of a dick if you didn't help. So this guy's just trying to be helpful, and the guy I'm talking to is like furious. He's ready to throw down with this guy over the suggestion to use four fingers on the climbing hold instead of three. So what's the big deal? It isn't a big deal to say four fingers instead of three, unless when you were a small child, you put your itty-bitty finger in the gears of your dad's lathe in the garage, in which case you only have three fingers left on that hand. And then saying four fingers rather than three makes a big difference. Not only saying use four fingers instead of three fingers to a three-fingered man not helpful, it's insulting. It's poking fun at a very real disability. So the words we choose, they matter, don't we? And when I say matter, I don't mean like they're important, although they are, and that words have meaning, although they do. What I mean is the words we choose have incredible power. We can choose a word that brings huge joy, or we can choose a word that hurts. We can choose words that bring peace, or we can choose words that lead to war. The choice of saying four instead of three had the power to start a fight at a climbing gym. Now, I have to admit, I am obsessed with words. Not in the I get a new word emailed to me every day kind of obsessed, although, as you know, I don't mind throwing out an obscure word now and again. My obsession is more about what words we choose, and what do we mean by those choices? The words we use aren't random. We choose them for a reason. It's not just a slip of the tongue. Let me show you what I mean. Remember that day, for all of you who are old enough to have experienced this, when you're staring into the eyes of the person you're dating? Instead of saying the words, I like you, you chose to use the words, I love you. What was casual is now much more than that, isn't it? You just put your heart on the line. And the next thing that they respond is absolutely critical. If they say, I love you back, suddenly life is wonderful again. The sky is more blue, the flowers smell sweeter, everything in life is better. But if they say, thanks, ouch. Or how about a court of law? When the judge reads the verdict, guilty is much different than innocent. Guilty represents a number of years of your life. Innocent means you walk out free. The word the judge chooses in that situation has great meaning. Guilty is very different than innocent. Or when your boss calls you into their office and suddenly you realize that they just said you worked here instead of you work here. Subtle change in tense has huge impact. You're most likely leaving that meeting with your desk in a box. The words we choose have a lot of meaning, don't they? We're deliberate about our word choices. When we say guilty, we don't mean innocent. When we say worked here, we don't mean work here. So why did a guy named Paul, the author of many books of the Bible about 2,000 years ago, choose the words he did? Why? We know the word choice has meaning, so why did he choose the words he did? And what do we do when the words Paul chose make us uncomfortable, maybe even offend us? This whole series has been focused on words that Paul wrote that have had huge power in the Christian church over the last 2,000 years. Words like, homosexuals will not get into heaven, or do nothing to cause another person to stumble, or what we're going to look at today. women should be silent in the church. If that's right, about half of you, including our music leader today, should be silent. These words have had power for the last few thousand years, haven't they? In most Protestant churches, women still can't be pastors. And only a few let women be leaders of the church in any way. In most communities, women couldn't preach like I'm doing today. The number of women biblical scholars are significantly lower than men. When we opened a pastoral job here at Friend Church to resumes a few years ago, we got like 10 or 20 to 1 men resumes to female resumes. The women who applied, their resumes weren't great. Probably because they have not had the same experiences to be leaders in Protestant churches. And in our day and age, it's a bit ridiculous, isn't it? Does anyone here actually think that women are not as intelligent as men? Does anyone think that women can't study the Bible with the same skill as men? Can provide leadership to the same level as men? Or in any way inferior to men? Yet we hold as sacred a book that says women should be silent in the church. And so for thousands of years they have been. They've been forced to be. And if you ask me, much to the detriment of the church, to the detriment of Christianity, and I think to the detriment of the world at large. So today I want to look at this seminal passage and figure out why this is any important to us at all. Okay, let's read the passage. Women should be silent during the church meetings. It's not proper for them to speak. They should be submissive, just as the law says. If they have any questions, they should ask their husbands at home, for it's improper for a woman to speak in the church meetings. This is from the first letter we have from Paul's correspondence with the church in Corinth. And as we've said before, this is probably either the third or maybe even the fifth letter that they wrote back and forth. But this is the first one that we have. So we're joining the conversation well into it. Think of it like walking into a group of people having a conversation about halfway through the conversation. Things aren't going to make much sense because you're missing the first half of the whole discussion. And there's been much said back and forth that we can only guess at. And because we're missing most of the conversation, much of this series has been trying to reconstruct what questions Paul's answering, or to reconstruct the situation Paul is speaking to. But today's not one of those days. Today I want to show you something a little different. I was a student teacher a few years ago at a little Catholic school in the Northwest with a little guy who had some severe behavioral problems. I remember walking to school one morning, and before I even got a chance to put my stuff away and go to the classroom to meet with my guy, the vice principal asked me to come into their office. So I walked in to see my little guy sitting in a chair, head down, and a girl standing beside him. And my guy was a social outcast. Kids didn't really play with him, didn't really like him. He was weird, kind of smelled some days, didn't say the right things, but he was desperate to be one of the cool kids. Desperate. And standing beside him was one of the cool kids. In fact, not just anyone, one of the ringleaders. So the principal starts talking about what they did. They stole some candy from the teacher's closet, you know. But then something interesting happened. The vice principal said to the two kids, "You're both going to be punished." I remember my guy's face just going white, like he'd seen a ghost or something. He was petrified. But the little girl's face didn't change much at all. In fact, if anything, she seemed kind of relieved. The word punished caused my guy to be scared out of his wits, most likely because with his background, punishment was bad, like really bad. He was in the foster system for a reason. I don't really know the whole story, but my only guess is probably involved beatings, just hurting him tremendously. And so when she said punished, he was horrified. But the little girl, the impression she gave was punishment in her family meant a slap on the wrist at best. Or maybe a threat never followed through with. She didn't even care. Have you ever wondered how we actually can communicate with each other? I know it seems a little silly, but think about it for a second. How is it that I can feel something deep inside my brain? I can translate that feeling into electrical impulses that ultimately lead my vocal cords to vibrate, my lips and tongue to shape words. And then your eardrums pick up that vibration that are being translated into electrical impulses that get translated into words in your head that invoke a series of feelings. How is it that this process leads to understand what I'm feeling? Or even understand what I'm trying to communicate? How can the feeling that is behind the word punished ever be communicated between my little guy and that little girl? Think about if she was feeling like her parents might slap her hand for doing something. If that was the feeling she was trying to communicate, she would use the word punishment to communicate that to my little guy. But the feeling that that word invokes in his mind would be nothing like hers. That's why communication experts tell us to active listen, to repeat what somebody says to us, but to use different words. Because words don't always invoke the same feeling in us as they do in somebody else. So using a single word is just too risky. So we need two or three words. Then when we realize that the overlap between those three words, we limit the amount of feelings that the word might conjure in somebody else. Let me use this example. If I were to say to you, I'm feeling quite positive today, what mental picture does that conjure in your head about me? And then after saying, I'm feeling positive today, I continue to say, I'm really charged up. Does that still fit with your mental picture? Probably. But what if I continue by saying, I could power your cell phone for like an hour? Now we probably have a problem, right? Because most of us were thinking, I was talking about my mood. Being positive and charged up can express a good mood, feeling motivated. But when I say I can power your phone, that clearly doesn't fit. So our minds go back to the first two sentences and realize that by positive and charged up, I'm not talking about mood. I'm talking about electricity. And the whole thing starts to make sense then. And we do this hundreds of times per day. We hear things, we guess at what the person might mean. We continue with that guess until we hit one of those wait a second moments. And then we rebuild our model of what they were saying. In biblical interpretation, we do the same thing. We're just a bit more obvious about it. So remember the first thing we read together about Paul? Women should be silent during the church meetings. What picture do you have in your heads when you read this? Like traditional Mennonite churches where all the women sitting silently while the men talk? Women not being leaders, not preaching, not having an influential voice in the community? Now I'd like to read you another passage from the same letter that Paul wrote. And in this one, Paul says something in an argument he has about appropriate attire. He says this, but a woman dishonors her head if she prays or prophesies without covering her head. For this is the same as shaving her head. Okay, the first question you're probably going to ask is, what's up with covering her head business and shaving it, right? Like, women with shaved heads look great. Think early 90s Sinead O'Connor. It's beautiful. But look again what it says about what the women are doing without their heads covered. Praying and prophesying. Let me change that into our language. Talking to God or talking for God to a group of people. Like a group of people at a church meeting. So Paul's assuming here that women actually do speak in the church meetings. So our model of women sitting silently doesn't fit this idea of women also talking, would it? The two meanings we have here are incompatible, which is just like my positive charge example. So clearly our assumption about what Paul's talking about here is flawed. Well, it's either that or Paul's completely contradicting himself in the same letter, but I don't think that's likely. Because I think there's a much simpler answer. What if I told you that like positive can refer to mood or electrical charge? So too the word silent can mean no speaking at all, or can mean not chattering. Chattering has this kind of talking without paying attention to those around feel, doesn't it? Teenage girls chattering at the mall with each other. They don't care who overhears them. That's the feeling of the word here. A group of women chattering during the service and is distracting the people around them. So Paul says, stop chattering during the church meetings. Simple, right? How many of you have chattered during a church service? How about during the church service today? It's not very many of you. So clearly this passage doesn't apply to us, right? Maybe this was an issue in Corinth, but not in Calgary. But let's push this further. Chattering is what causes distraction in Corinth. But what distracts people around here? How about our cell phones? That text or that email we just have to do during the service. How about when we lose track of why we're here, we start to stretch and move around, fidget? How about when I just have to tell the person next to me something important? Or what about something a bit more subtle? Maybe it's not connecting to the people around us. bathroom breaks. My parents never let us go to the bathroom during service. That was, yeah, offside. At the time, I thought they were just sadistic, but maybe there's something more to it. Now, this isn't meant to be a law of things you can't do. But let me ask, are you aware of how your actions impact people around you here at the spiritual gym? Community means that we're together, so our actions impact the people around us. So are you aware of how your actions are distracting people around you who are trying to get a spiritual workout? We don't all chatter, do we? But we chatter. So did Paul want women to be silent in the church in Corinth? Nah, I don't think that's what Paul's getting at here. Is this conclusive? No. In interpretation, nothing ever is. That's why I have so many difficult issues in our own communication, because understanding what a person means is a difficult task. Should we apply this truck directly to our context today? Again, no, definitely not. This was written to a church in Corinth almost 2,000 years ago. I don't believe it was meant for us. Does that mean we can't learn from it? Of course we can. We just need to look underneath the issues they were dealing with 2,000 years ago and look at the heart of the problem. So this is the last message in a series called The Story Behind the Words of Paul. So I'd like to say a few things to end this series. First, the series was not designed to deconstruct all you knew about Paul, although we did do some of that. We did it because we wanted you to see the words of Paul through fresh eyes, without your previous understanding getting in the way. Not to devalue Paul or to devalue traditional interpretation. Too often people in the last decade have decided that Paul's words are too based in a particular time and place, based on a particular situation that we can't know. So they've thrown out all the words of Paul. People will say things like, we're Christians, we follow Christ, not Paul. Or they'll say, I follow Jesus, Paul's a misogynist rule maker, it has nothing to do with Jesus. While I don't think Paul's on par with Jesus, I do think that Paul is an incredibly important contributor to Christianity. So that's the first thing. Second thing, I'd like to say a few words about the letter from Paul to the church in Corinth. I think the church in Corinth has some amazing similarities to our church in Calgary, actually. Both are located in cities that are rich because of location. In Calgary, it's our proximity to oil and natural gas. Church in Corinth, it was their proximity to trade routes. So they were wealthy even when cities around them were not. And while riches are often nice, riches do lead to more possibilities, don't they? It's hard to get into too much trouble when you're poor and you have nothing. When all you do is struggle to put food on the table, all of your energy goes into survival. When money's plentiful, so too are opportunities. Pastor here in Calgary calls money a choice multiplier. And when you have lots of money, the multiplier becomes large. In Calgary, the options available to us are many. So too in ancient Corinth. Second, Calgary is a multicultural city. We have great ethnic diversity, and so we have great religious diversity. So too in Corinth. They had Jews and Greeks and all their religion, and the Romans and their emperor cult, all together within the walls of the city. In Calgary, we're trying to figure out how to follow the way of Christ in a city where being a Christian is a negative thing. We're constantly trying to figure out a balance between accepting those around us and being true to our spiritual lives. The church in Corinth was dealing with these same things, trying to figure out how to be a Christian in a Greco-Roman world. And while Calgary isn't Corinth, I don't believe we should apply Paul's words directly to our own situation. I think that the letter to the church in Corinth parallels our spiritual journey here in Calgary. They're asking questions about situations that we don't really experience, things like head coverings or meat offered to idols. But the heart of their questions are the same as the heart of our questions. What does it mean to follow the way of Christ in our world? What does that mean? And we've explored a number of the questions over the last 6 weeks. Questions like today, how to be a good member of a church community? How to not be a distraction to those around us at the spiritual gym? Jeff asked the question, how do our actions impact people in the rest of our lives? We talked about who can be part of the church. What's healthy sexuality? Can we be proud of the water we bring to this world? Who can we judge? How does our church relate to the churches around us, to other Christians around us? And these are really good questions for us to be contemplating, aren't they? They're the questions that I think the church in Corinth was dealing with. So should we throw out the words of Paul and focus on the words of Jesus? No, I don't think so. Because I think we'd miss some profound questions that we're dealing with right now in Calgary in 2013. I think we'd miss the insight that our spiritual ancestors would bring to bear on these questions. So I want to challenge each and every one of you. Go back to the letters to the church in Corinth. Read a section. Then ask yourself, what questions might have sparked that answer? Share the discussion with friends and family. Ask, what questions do they think Paul's answering? And then wrestle with your own answer to that question. Why? So that we can be more prepared to live out our spiritual journey we call Christianity here in Calgary. So may we go out here today stronger in our knowledge of what it means to follow Jesus in our unique time and place. And I hope we all leave here with a greater appreciation of the words of Paul to the church in Corinth. Have a great day.